Hello and welcome to the Liberation Podcast, an exploration of what it means when we say our liberation is bound in each other. Through interviews and personal dialogue, we will dissect just how liberation is experienced by the individual and how in result manifests in their communities. Let's get started. Hello, welcome back to the Liberation Podcast. I'm your host, Safara Parrott. Thank you so much for joining in and listening to my sweet voice. Today, I am joined by ethnobotanist and documentarian Anthony B. Rodriguez. And before I intro Anthony a little bit more, I just want to do a tiny bit of housekeeping, let you know what's going on with the show. If you haven't noticed already, the show is scaled back to once a month now. Life gets crazy. Other things need to take priority. I don't get a paycheck for this job. So I still obviously want to be creating this content and want to facilitate these conversations because if anything, they are edifying enough for my life that I would like to continue doing it. And hopefully they are to you as well. Along with that, because I'm scaling back and I am devoting a little bit less hours to creating this show, I'm also going to pause the Patreon for a little while. There are not enough hours in the day for me to continue running it, and I am not wanting to squander people's payments or squander their expectations of what I set up the Patreon to be. So it's going to be paused for a little bit. I'm not going to delete it. I'm just going to pause payments until I either scale the podcast back up or I don't know if I just feel like starting it again. But I will make that announcement if it does return back. I will make that announcement. There you go. So the Patreon link, it'll still be active. You can still sign up to be a patron. The payments will just be paused for a little while. Along with that, I also have been trying to pay more attention to the website as well. I know when I launched the podcast, I was really hoping to feature a lot of Black and POC creatives, either writers or visual artists, and kept up with it for a little while, but then was not able to dedicate a lot of time to that. And so this is an open call for anyone listening or anyone who, you know, might know people who are creatives. Yeah, send them my way. I want to feature them. I want to feature as much diverse art as possible, and it can be any and all things. There's no medium that is denied by any means. So if you know anyone, if you yourself are a creative, please send me your stuff via the podcast email, or you can DM me and I can send you the submission flyer, any of those things. I would greatly appreciate it. Let's help ourselves build a little art community. That would be very sweet and nice and tender. And I think the world might need a little bit of an art community at this time. So more on Anthony. Anthony Basil Rodriguez is a New York-born independent photographer and filmmaker. Since childhood, he has been oriented towards a range of visual worlds. As a teenager, Anthony began to carry around an old film camera that his younger brother had lying around from a school project. Eventually, taking his hobby more seriously, Anthony obtained a job pushing carts in order to buy his first digital camera. One day, after a thunderstorm, he was discovered by a local news station knee-deep in floodwaters collecting photos of the aftermath. He spent the following 3 years submerged in live television, editing daily news cards. During this time, he honored and developed a true eye and skill for editing, videography, and ultimately, storytelling. Since leaving the news industry, Anthony has continued to push his craft, interlacing realms of photography, video, and film. This work continues to bring Anthony around the world in pursuit and research of documentation of rare plants, desperate people, and flux of global society. If you are unaware of what ethnobotany means or what it is defined as, Ethnobotany is the scientific study of the traditional knowledge and customs of a people concerning plants and their medicinal, religious, and other uses. So it is a pretty rough history of ethnobotany. As you guessed it, it's rooted in colonialism. As the actual formal science study of ethnobotany is rooted in colonialism. Many times when an imperialistic state, so France, UK, Dutch, all of the general colonizers that we are aware of, if they were Spanish as well, if they were coming into specific uncharted territory or into different villages or different areas of a country, they would often send scientists to kind of peruse and understand like what the actual vegetation was like, what were the conditions of the land, etc. Many of these scientists were freelance scientists, and they would come in contact with indigenous people, and others were better than some, but more often than not, many of these scientists would invade these indigenous people's spaces. They would take a lot of medicinal plants, they would take different religious-centered plants, and create them into a very sterile and medical situation of discovery. And then oftentimes that imperialistic nation, whatever they're doing, will come into those villages and start setting up camps. They started using the indigenous people as scientific studies, so not engaging them in any ethical way, but using them as science and making them into like a weird prop. And so that's really what the root of ethnobotany started as. Granted, yes, there are specific individual scientists that would travel around the world and, as ethically as they could in the mid-1800s, involve themselves with indigenous people, and I'm sure there are many stories of that. But as we categorically know ethnobotany, it does have a rather intense history of colonization. And I think it's important to come into this conversation knowing that, because Anthony, being a diasporic man, going into ethnobotany and having to read the texts of these people that were involved in colonialism, and having to decipher what's actually important, and that informing his next moves of who to speak to and how to speak to them, and developing a work ethic that is centered around respect and connection between the people that are living with these plants, people that protect plants, people that cultivate, people that involve themselves in permaculture to protect and prolong the life of certain plants. All of this is really important, and I feel that is very important to also have that base knowledge of where ethnobotany comes from. With that being said, my conversation with Anthony was really a pleasure to have. He has such a heart and clear head about how he engages with people and how he engages with plants. It's in his bones, it's ancestral for him, and it's really beautiful to hear someone talk about something that is in their bones and something that is so natural to come across, and something that is known as a gatekeeping and highly intellectual and highly academic study, and making it more accessible to people. Seeing that documentation is so important, and all of these communications are so important. I was just really pleased and really honored to have Anthony speak about that, and where he sees the future of ethnobotany going and the accessibility and its relation to climate change. All these things were really beautiful to hear, and I hope that it touches all of you as well. I'm sure it will. Yeah, that's all I have to intro this episode. If you would like to keep up with the show, know more about my life, etc., you can follow me on Instagram. You can also go on the liberationpodcast.com little website. And as I said before, all of the links to find Anthony's work will be in the show description as well. He has a great website that you can watch reels, and you can also donate to his work so that he can continue traveling, and you can sign up for his newsletter, all of the great things. You can also see some of his beautiful photography. And just keep up with the things and the ongoings of a traveling ethnobotanist. And without further ado, this is my conversation with Anthony B. Rodriguez. Cool. So if you're comfy, all your stuff is rolling, we're just going to go right in. Is that cool?
Yeah, that's cool. Let's go.
All right. Well, Anthony, thank you for agreeing to be on so quickly, too. I was not expecting you to respond so fast. I know that your story of getting into documentary making comes from career in news media and filming for news. But I'm curious of how you got from storytelling through news and then transforming that into storytelling about plants. And also, what was your early connection to plants? Because people don't just go from news to botany. That's not like a natural movement. So I'm quite curious of what that kind of upbringing or early life around botany and plant sciences and stuff came from, and then how you transformed it from one storytelling career to another, you know?
Well, thank you for having me on the show, by the way. And the plants, I've been into botany since I was a child, since like the age of 7. When I was a kid, I actually used to collect carnivorous plants. And there was this one nursery in Canandaigua, New York, upstate New York. And I used to just order like Venus fly traps, Darlingtonias, and all these weird like carnivorous plants as a kid. And so since I was a child, I just like plants. You know, I used to watch a lot of nature shows, and, you know, it just stuck with me since I was young. And I started to get into edible foods when I became plant-based. Because my love for plants was kind of already there, but I was more into weird stuff, you know? But then once I started to eat a little bit more plant-based, I started learning a little bit more about the various vegetables and edible foods from around the world. I grew up in New York City, and I moved to Connecticut when I was 16. And when I got to Connecticut, we had a backyard. So it was like my first time having a backyard, and I started gardening and growing food and, you know, getting into the forest more and, you know, foraging and learning about the plants that are there and the trees. And so that progressed, you know, and then, skip a couple of years, maybe 10 years, 5 years, and I landed a job in news. I was 21 years old when I landed in news. That was kind of like my entryway into the storytelling aspect, like of video work. I was always into photography. I'd been taking photos since I was like in high school, and it was film prior to that, and I started to move into digital, and it just progressed.
Were you given any kind of like oral traditions or anything about like when you were gardening and learning more about like plant life? Were you given, or like was anyone there to like kind of tell you already that plants have these kind of stories or like a relationship to culture and stuff like that? Or was that like a personal finding of yours? Like, did you find out that plants have these like cultural stories within different areas of the world?
Well, both of my parents are from the Caribbean. My father is Puerto Rican, my mother's Jamaican. And on my mother's side, I come from a long lineage of herbalists and farmers. I come, like my grandmother, she's, and a lot of people in my family, they're very much close with the herbs and natural foods and, you know, home medicines and a lot of like old indigenous like root tonics and things of that nature. It's very embedded in Jamaican culture. I always had some type of reference in my like day-to-day life growing up in a Caribbean home of like how we use plants. You know, my grandmother would like boil Circe and like, you know, strongback and like all the different, you know, herbs to, you know, heal the body and just keep your vitality high. So, you know, seeing these type of things, you know, I guess I was always in it in some way.
Yeah, that's it's really beautiful in a diasporic way that like in with Black folks and or any kind of immigrant culture that people have such a like a DNA based relation to plants or kind of your like habitual nature towards plants. And yeah, that's so beautiful. I love hearing that every single time I talk to somebody if they have like grandmas or full family lines of herbalists. So we're skipping over the kind of the news career. You've transitioned out of it, and you are now you're documenting plants, and you're creating this career of ethnobotany through a really specific way of digital documentation. And so I'm curious of what your preparation looks like, both in your research for a specific subject, how and when you pick locations, different species of plants. Yeah, if you want to tell me a little bit more about what that process looks like.
Well, maybe I can start with a little bit of a story. For example, in 2019, where I started my Banana World tour, this is a project that's been like in conception for a long time. Probably around 2015, I wanted to start to photograph wild bananas. When I first saw like a photo of a wild banana, I was baffled that it was even a banana. So I just started like diving into the botanical and taxonomy of wild species of bananas, and that's just one of many things. But for that particular project, it took a bunch of years of just like gaining knowledge through research. I would find published papers, book references. To wild species and their locations and their ethnobotanical uses, and just like dream of going there. So in 2019, I actually have a friend in Hawaii who was growing this very interesting banana called Fahy potia. Fahy is the banana that's it's well known in the South Pacific, throughout the Pacific. What we eat is very different, and there's very old varieties out there. So a friend of mine who was growing this banana that was native to Fiji, but it went extinct in Fiji in the 1920s. It went extinct, and it's huge. It's about the size of a breadfruit. And I remember he got two of the plants, and he was saying, "Hey, I got these plants, but there's gonna take about 2 years to flower." So he's taking care of them, the last couple of plants. And I get a call from him one day, and he's saying, "Hey, the plant is ready to harvest. They're fruiting." So when I get to Hawaii, I just start photographing the harvesting of this plant and a little bit about the culture and some of the weird varieties. And that was like the beginning of that trip. I ended up going to Thailand on the next part of that banana expedition. Went to a few other places, but they weren't relevant to the actual expedition. And then when I got to Thailand, that's where I start to see the first bunch of wild species, Musa acuminata. Musa is the genus of bananas, and acuminata is the species. That's the most common, Musa acuminata and Musa balbisiana, the two ones that we use for cultivation. The banana you buy in the store, the Cavendish. It's of that genetic genome, stuff that genome. So, yeah, I would just research these plants like via PDFs that I get from like ResearchGate and other academia platforms. And sometimes you get like a coordinate, or you get a little bit of the ethnobotanical uses. So you just go to these areas, you find like a little town, like say it says the town of Kapit, and you say, "I'm gonna go to Kapit," and you go there, and then you go to the markets and you start looking for things, and you're like, "Wow, that looks interesting," and you start asking questions, and it just kind of unfolds into this. Everything happens very organically.
Yeah, it's funny because so I mean, for any guest, but I am particularly, I don't want to say, I don't want to say the word ignorant because I'm not, but I was just, I'd had a lot, I didn't know much about the field of ethnobotany outside of just like, obviously this is what it is, this is what it is. I'm super into that. But I was reading about the history of ethnobotany and surprise, surprise, it's rooted in colonialism.
Big time.
And it's interesting, too, because usually it was German or English settlers that would come into places like Africa, Southeast Asia, whatever, whomever. And not only like come in and ask hard italicized quotes, ask to see their relationship to plants and things like that, but also like still not use any of the knowledge of the people that are there and like respect their actual space or like give them any dignity whatsoever. And then oftentimes would create villages in those areas and like gentrify those villages and then put those indigenous people on like showcases so that like higher up aristocracies, people of the countries that they're coming from, can come and see their good work, whatever. So that's like the historical basis of this study. But it seems like in this time, there's way, it's a much more approachable subject in the sense that, like myself, I can go, I know where there are specific people. I'm based in Nashville, if you didn't know. There is a woman just outside of Nashville who's an indigenous woman who teaches people specific medicinal uses for indigenous plants of Middle Tennessee. There are specific places that I know that I can go and learn this and not come into it as a way of like, I'm taking your resources and whatever. So it seems like in the way that you're describing how you go about this process of documenting, that it's also maybe more like it seems like a much more, like you said, holistic and natural way of going about it, as opposed to this very odd clinical and very much colonial aspect of looking at it as well.
Indeed. And it's funny you mention that, because a lot of the papers that I read, some of them are very outdated, you know, some going back to mid-1800s. And when you're reading the writings of some of these colonists who are, you know, describing the food or making illustrations and describing the people, it's from a very colonialistic, like, perspective.
Totally.
You know, but there's little bits and pieces that you can pull from some of these papers to reference to get you where you need to get.
Yeah. So I'm curious, when you are documenting, because I know you also like you have photo series of like children of the world and different things like that. And I remember watching this behind the scenes of this like National Geographic, like behind the photographers of National Geographic. And I remember like seeing them posing shots that I feel like, as an audience member or flipping through like History Channel or like National Geographic magazine, like you would assume these are natural shots. Like they're just like, we're walking around or whatever. So I'm curious of how you balance this notion between like setting up a scene, quote unquote, and then also allowing like freedom and natural movement and, it within your documenting, because you do a different forms of documenting. So I'm wondering how you kind of marry those little things.
Well, most of the people that I photograph, I've spent time with. So it's already like a level of trust, you know. Let's say the Solomon Islands, for example. That was probably one of my most favorite countries I visited. I lived with two groups of people for a month each time. So, you know, I spent in the island of Guadalcanal with a family for about a month and 10 days. I lived with them, you know, so Yeah, there's really no setting up. I try to shoot as much candid as I can, unless I want them to, like, pose with something. I'm like, hey, could you just hold this? And then, but most of the time they're giggling and laughing, and we're already having a good time, or like prior to me pulling out a camera, So it just feels very natural, and because I just get to know these people.
Sure. And it seems like, I guess, I mean, the different methodology of filming and doing photography and such, like when you're on like the reel that you have of visiting Hawaii and like having to document that, you're it's very much like it almost has its own built narrative. It's like, I'm coming to Hawaii, we are harvesting this banana, we are learning like tricks, not tricks of the trade, but how these are taken care of, the story of it, and then resolution is like, we now have a documentation of a banana. Like that is like the resolution of it. And so I can see where the methodology is a bit different, where it's like that doesn't really require as much, not that it doesn't require as much trust, but it doesn't require as much as a I don't know. I'm trying to find the correct word, because obviously there is trust there. Somebody is letting you see an indigenous and very, very endangered plant. So I feel that also does require quite a bit of trust there.
Well, that particular shot was grown, but wasn't grown by indigenous people. That particular banana, it was someone who's a caretaker. He's a permaculturalist, and he got a hold of plants. So because he had the skill sets to basically keep it alive, he just would have been working on that, and trying to like just save that particular variety. In terms of me visiting indigenous people of the world, it's much different. I feel a lot of the things I'm photographing, for example, it's normal to them. It's more odd to me. It's more interesting to me than it is to them, because this is their life.
Totally.
This is their everyday thing, Like when we walk through New York City, and I mean, when I walk through New York City and I see all these skyscrapers, I'm no longer going, ooh, ah, But
Totally.
somebody comes here, they're like, wow, New York City. So it's like, it's kind of the same thing. So they're just like baffled that I want to take a picture of a banana most of the time. They're like, why do you want to take a picture of this? Like, we cut these down,
Totally. Totally.
So it's like, wow, where I come from, we don't ever see anything like this. So it's, you just try to get that point across.
Yeah, it's interesting too. That just makes me think of like when you're traveling, like if you're in Thailand or if you're in India, explaining of like well, in the States, not speaking for, obviously there are plenty of people, indigenous and permaculturists, that are trying to combat climate change and are kind of love to destroy things that are nice and sustainable for our lives. But it's hard to describe, or to like, there would be no reason to tell them, you're like, oh no, you don't get it. Like in my country or where I'm living, like we destroy this shit. Like we, like this is something that like we, I like, I am in awe of this because it's something that is like in its pure form. Like it's not manufactured in some weird way, or it doesn't have a Chiquita sticker on it or like whatever. So I mean, yeah, that's like a weird position that you're kind of in too, of like I would think I am projecting myself in that situation where it'd be like I would want to explain of like this is really fucking cool, but like yeah, obviously that's not really necessary, I would assume.
Yeah, I think they're I think people are just happy to have visitors most of the time, happy to have genuine people to visit and enjoy their culture, who want to learn how they speak, who is interested in their life, yeah, it's pretty casual.
So I'm curious, I was reading, as I was like preparing, I was reading for about ethnobotany and more of like the modern practice and like where it sits as a modern science. It seemed like there's kind of like a tug of war of kind of the position of what ethnobotany, of where ethnobotany sits within like a historian role versus like kind of a discovery role, or more of like a, like shining a light on specific things. And like, I can see it for both. And I can't help but think that, you know, with the ongoing climate disruption and crisis that we find ourselves in, like I see it as like almost a historian position, because it is kind of like, it feels like it's almost like a game of catch up where it's like, oh, here's this endangered species. Here's this, or here's just like a species that has a very small genus pool or whatever. And so it's like, I feel anxious thinking about it, of like, I need to capture it all. Like if I were an ethnobotanist or if I was a documenteur. So I'm curious of what your thought process is, and how do you feel you fit in with that kind of framework, or if you don't feel that you belong within that dichotomy of like historian or discovery?
Well, I do feel part of the work is historian work. For example, the Banana Project is a deep entanglement with the human migration across the world, with the human story. And that's mostly what fascinated me in the first place, is the historical use behind a lot of these things, how these things were traded, you know, these empires that existed long before, you know, that and a lot of these things are being lost. A lot of these things I'm looking for are disappearing because of deforestation. I've seen, for example, my trips to Borneo, I've seen hundreds of miles of you're speaking about the oldest rainforest in the world. It was unaffected by the ice age, and they're destroying it, literally chopping it down to plant oil palm, which is used for, like, you know, processed foods like Pop-Tarts and you know, all these pastries and things that we throw it in. And I just feel it's important to document these things, you know, before they're like completely gone. And then to also document the uses that the cultures have, because also the cultures are being disrupted from just the contemporary life, the internet and all these things, these products that are coming into their country. And, you know, it's just, people are not really living the old ways. It's just like, oh, my great grandmother used to eat that, or, you know, a lot of it's being lost, you know. Sometimes I like to go to places that are pretty much time capsules, you know, that are a little less developed, where people are dependent on their natural surroundings to live, because those are the people that are still keeping a majority of their culture intact.
I'm curious how you feel. So this kind of made me feel or think about, I don't remember if it was, God, I wish I remember who I was listening to, but I think I was listening to like a Bell Hooks seminar or something. I wish I remember who, but they were talking about how, what has to happen to on the inside to an individual when capitalism and colonialism are part of your culture, and how that, like, when it invades into another person's like culture or resources, and like how to engage in that action of like cutting down, like deforestation or whatever, how much of yourself and your like ancestral line you have to cut off. And I'm so curious of like that relationship to people, that to corporations and whoever who, or even people who live in the country who sell the land to corporations. Like, I'm so curious of what that relationship looks like to themselves, because it's when you said like, oh, my great grandmother used to eat that or use this as a medicine. that just tells me, like, you're cutting something off from yourself.
For sure.
And that's a really powerful thing. And I'm sure for you, when you are witnessing and experiencing these things with folks that you meet in your travels, of, and I'm sure people tell you stories of, our land used to be in a larger area, or we used to have a specific water resource that isn't viable anymore, or whatever. Like, I'm sure that you hear story after story of that reality. And it's just such an interesting thing that's at play, of like, people of their own culture and country, like, are also kind of cutting themselves off from that by allowing this level of like corruption to happen to indigenous people's lands, or not even just to end to the land, period. Like, capital T, capital L, the land.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a machine, you know, this thing we built, this economy, it's everywhere now. And we've also been selling these images across the world. You know, you have people who are seeing images of people living the way we live in the Western world, and they want that, you know, and they're willing to give up their way of life to try to achieve that, not really knowing what that really entails, or how hard that really is. So it's a rough situation.
Yeah, and it's again, you like you it, that's like anytime somebody I know I'm friends with plenty of people who come from a diasporic background, whether they're coming from as immigrants or they are of a Black diaspora of enslavement or whatever. It's so many, I hear like so many times, especially with people who are of Hispanic or Asian descent, where they are really, their parents really cutting themselves off from specific parts of their own culture to appeal to this kind of American idealism or whatever. And it's like, it's heartbreaking, but you also like, at least in my position, who I'm not in their position, like, you can't be mad at them either, because they're getting fed this specific ideal. And so it's just like, do you have to approach it with what I would assume, like, and what I try to do is just, you have to approach it with compassion and being like, you can love the culture you are from and also want to be like you will be successful if you are like successful, not in like the monetary way necessarily, but just like, you will also thrive even if you allow these parts of yourself to thrive. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we're living in a world where these things are inevitable. So it's just adapting and trying to preserve at the same time transform. So as we move forward into this new world, this new age, we want to keep the wisdom of the indigenous thinking, but also have the contemporary advancements and try to kind of harmonize, if that's a word.
It's a word now. You said it. It's a word. That's how language works.
Yeah. If we want to just make these, I think we need to have a contemporary thinking with the wisdom of the old kind of merged to have this new contemporary way of living on this planet, you know, because we have to, if we want to prosper, you know?
Yeah. That's what your that series, is it called Growing Back to Nature?
Back to Nature, the series.
That's what that was the central theme of that.
Correct.
The adaptation of modern science and culture, but also like, staying true and knowing of that indigenous science and language and stuff. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
That series is something that I've been working on for a while now, too. I mean, the first time I shot anything for that was back in 2017. And I'm an independent filmmaker, so, you know, these things take time. But when that project is, like, fully launched, I think it's going to be really great. And it's going to be good examples of how we can move. And I'm trying to find people who are making these changes economically, culturally, socially, on living harmonious with the natural world, but also, you know, living in the world we created.
Totally. Yeah, it's funny. I think the more I personally just kind of invest more time in learning about this. I also garden myself and try to eat as seasonally as possible and try to center what I'm eating and how I interact with plants as holistically as possible. And the more I do that, I get connected to different people that are around me or globally. And yeah, it's pretty incredible how, like, it's not easy to, like, grow your own food and reconnect in that kind of way. But it feels like almost like in a therapeutic, like, in therapy, they teach you to tap in and speak to your inner child. Like, it feels like that same kind of work where it's like, oh, I'm tapping into this, like, science or this, these relationships that I already had somewhere in the blood, somewhere in, like, spiritually, somewhere ancestrally. And it's like you're kind of like relearning how to ride a bike again and doing all this. And it's really incredible what getting involved with plant relationships does for your own relationships and your own connectivity to people. And I see that over and over and over again. And yeah, the permaculture and this intertwining between indigenous and modern science, like, yeah, I hope, I cross my fingers that this is like a continual trend. And I think it is, because people are gonna need to grow their own food, but it's a really nice trend to see, and it's interesting how it plays out, and I'm curious to see how your series how it documents that, because I love to see the different interpretations and the different methodologies that people use for that.
Yeah, and I like you used the word trend, because I think that's important, that to kind of infiltrate the mainstream is to make loving earth trendy. We have to just make it cool again to be a human.
Yeah.
Naturally, you know. And you know, it's only been a couple hundred years we've been doing things the way we're doing it now.
Right.
So when you stick your hand in the soil or put your bare feet on the ground, you're activating something that your ancestors have been doing for thousands of years.
Totally.
You've been doing that way longer than you have been on an iPhone or
100%,
been working a 9-to-5. So it's automatically going to activate something in your soul and your spirit and your genetics, you know? So just getting tapped in, you know, you're just going to get them downloads.
Totally. And I'm curious, because I know, I mean, you've done, how many countries have you visited now?
Probably around 50-something. I don't know. I haven't really counted.
Yeah, I'm sure. I feel like once it's gone past, like, 30, there's no need to do a tally mark anymore. But, so I'm curious, like, with that, I'm sure that you have found different themes that might have created through lines, like, through different cultures. Obviously, like, the banana is a through line, like that you were saying earlier, is a through line of cultures, of being like a massive connection to different cultures globally. But either plant related, doesn't have to be plant or whatever, what are some of the through lines that you have found in your travels and connecting to people that you found across different cultures?
Consistent themes. Well, I think this is why I chose the banana, because it's something that everybody knows what looks like.
Totally.
It's something that everybody has eaten. It's one of those fruits that have been shipped to all corners of the world.
Yeah.
So I think showing the diversity of that and the historical implications of that has been like the main goal, because I'm using that as my through line, you know. Okay, right. Everybody, right? Like I always say, my audience is anyone who has ever eaten a banana.
Totally.
And that's pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone has eaten a banana.
Yeah.
At some point in their life, you know. So so it's like, okay, we all have that much in common.
Right.
Okay. So now let me show you a little bit deeper of this fruit that everybody knows.
Totally.
You know, and how has it changed you? How has it changed humanity's history? How has it changed the course of human history? How has it changed your life without you even knowing it? So that's basically, you know, I try to find things that we all can relate to and, you know, just try to like hone in on that, you know?
Okay, so minus the colonial part, the colonization part of the history of ethnobotany, how do you feel that, and we kind of touched on it a little bit when we were talking about like historian position versus like discovery or whatever, but how do you feel that how do you feel about the future of ethnobotany in the sense of that I feel like when I was reading and I was like reading like requirements to be considered ethnobotanist or like whatever, it in the beginning it seemed like in the early 1800s, when it was like the earliest accounts of ethnobotany up until probably like, I don't know, I think it's somewhere in the 1950s, that it was like extremely academic. And like was very much higher education. You had to study linguistics. You had to study the specific methodologies. You had to blank, blank, blank. But it seems now that this kind of study or this practice, and I like to kind of think of it as a practice as opposed to like this scientific study, even though it is scientific. How do you feel that is changing with like accessibility to technology, to traveling, to, you know, you research through academic papers that already exist, you know, how do you feel like the future of ethnobotany will change with like more technology and accessibility?
Well, we are in the age of information. I mean, it's only been what, 40 years, 50 years, like less than 40 years since we had the internet.
Right. Yeah.
I've shadowed under a lot of botanists and ethnobotanists, and just hearing what they had to do in the 80s and the 70s, or
totally,
you know, it was just not a thing that anyone can do. It's very academic. It still is very academic. I mean, there is a very deep academic side to everything that's being done.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit more adventure and casual at the same time, you know. You can get access to these papers. You can get access to this information via the internet, you know. Right. And if you're a smart person and you have a bit of, like, you know, botanical expertise, you know, you can pretty much, you know, put your mind to it and get it done, you know.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I feel like it can kind of teeter on the edge of, like, you know, like environmental tourism, but kind of like, you know, when like white people go to South America to do ayahuasca or something and they like want to have this like spiritual experience or something. And then like, but in reality, they're staying in like a resort that like took land from people. Like, you know what I mean? And I feel like with technology, and I think we've been teetering this line in general as a society for, you know, the last 25, 30 years of like high speed internet, that like the how casual can we get? You know what I mean?
Of, yeah, like, yeah.
Should I say, ooh, I learned about the Mayan interpretation of like magic mushrooms or like psilocybin and like whatever, I'm gonna go to this specific village that like has a like a religion, like they intertwine, there is a village in like in Mayan country, I'm like in the general, I don't remember exactly where it is in Mexico, but they have a, there's a specific village that intertwines psilocybin mushrooms and their Catholic religion. It's very interesting. It is really cool. But I'm just like imagining, like, if I was some, like, not to dunk on TikTokers, but if I was some TikTok kid, I was like, oh, I'm going to go to this village and I'm going to like document it on TikTok and like whatever. I feel like there's such an easy way to like exploit that village or like exploit this kind of this area and space. And so I feel like, yeah, with accessibility, you're on this weird line of like too casual, but don't want to like, but can't, maybe aren't, higher education isn't accessible or like whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess casual wasn't a good word.
No, it's okay. I just, it triggered something in my own mind.
For sure. I think, well, with me, I personally try to keep these things pretty authentic. You know, I'm not really, I don't know. It's pretty organic the way that I do things, you know?
Totally.
I get down and dirty, you know, I will sleep in the same place and with these people. I would eat in the same place. I would, you know, have the same morning routine as them. Right. You know, just become just a local, you know, I become a local and I'm just documenting my journey. I just keep it natural, you know?
Yeah. 100, yeah, absolutely.
This morning, I just released a short film. It's called The Culture of Chewing Betel Nut. So, yeah, it's just my journey through the Solomon Islands, India, Borneo. This was on my banana expedition, and I found that people were chewing this stimulant. And I made it, I began to chew this with them for about, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks. And yeah, I made a little documentary. Little something short. It's about 7 minutes.
A stimulant, as in it like chemically reacts in your body.
Correct. You chew it. Whoa. Makes your body feel warm. You feel euphoric. It's like aware, alert.
Whoa.
Yeah. But it become very addicting as well. So it's not like the greatest thing to be chewing. It makes your teeth red and stains your teeth.
Whoa. Is it a seed in a banana or is it a different plant?
It's the it's a palm seed from Areca cacti, the Areca palm. And they chew it and they mix it with lime, which activates another chemical in it. And some people mix it with tobacco as well, and some put herbs, you know, in the Southeast Asia they mix it with like different herbs to give it different flavors. In the Solomon Islands we had them fresh. And we mixed it with the inflorescence of the piper plant, piper betel. Yeah. And you just chew it and it just makes you happy. So I just made a little cut, you know, of my experience using that. So I was,
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for giving me your time.
It was a pleasure.
And for doing your work. It's really important in the way that you do it. I am always moved by people who make intentional steps to be connected to the people that they work with and the environments and the cultures that they work with. So I really appreciate that work because it's not easy, even though it is like you say, like you do approach it naturally. It's still like, it's not easy. Every culture is different. Every living situation is different. You know, you have to be adaptable. And that's really cool and really difficult work. And I appreciate that. And, yeah, Godspeed on the rest of your documentation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you again so much to Anthony Rodriguez for his very sweet and well-put words about his work in ethnobotany and the importance of documentation, and how, without even knowing it, we as people are so affected by the history and the uses of plants. And it's so important to see that. And like he said, you know, we're not that separated from when we used plants all the time. The uses of technology and industrialization are maximum about 100 years old, with like high industrialization. And that's not too separated from our bodies, you know. And so it's really important to have this and to really honor the relationships that we as human beings have had with plants for so long and that we can return to. It's in our genes, it's in our bones. We can return to that, and I think it's so important. So yeah, thank you so much, Anthony. If you want to get in contact with him or see any of his work and support his work, all of the links will be in the show notes. If you want to contact me, or if you're an artist and are interested in submission forms, all of that will also be below. Thank you all for listening, and I will see you next time.